Solitaire Rose Novelcast, After the Fall, Episode 6. What has gone before? After the Fall is set 5 years after civilization has fallen due to a zombie apocalypse. There is a zombie who calls himself Eddie, who is able to think, able to talk, able to plan. He seems to be a new breed of the zombies, because most of the zombies that have been in the novel are Romero-style zombies. We also know that there is a same-sex couple raising 4 children that they have taken from different shelters. They've barricaded themselves in a farmhouse and have built a quiet life. For this part, that is what you will need to know. And I hope you enjoy this episode. Eddie had walked along areas that were fields of corn, wheat, and soybeans back at some point. There were acres of land outlined by fence post and barbed wire that sagged and had grown rusty over the years, even before things had fallen apart. He was looking for more farmhouses. The pain wasn't bad now. He'd fed within the last few days and was moving north, drawn by some inner voice he didn't understand. Was it memory? He didn't remember his past life, but there had to be traces. He had language, knowledge, even some muscle memory for small tasks, but who he was before things changed was lost to him. He could tell that the hunger wasn't controlling everything about him, because he could observe as he walked. When the hunger drove him and filled his body with pain, all he could sense was the smell of living humans. He could hear things that seemed as if they had to be from humans. Conversation, gunshots, sounds of building or tearing things apart. People had learned that those sounds traveled further than they thought they did. Those that hadn't learned it in time were gone now. As Eddie walked past the abandoned field, he surveyed the land. He figured it must have grown corn the last time because there were still a few small, sickly-looking corn stalks among the other grasses that had grown up over the years. He'd been walking for a couple of days, staying away from the roads. Yes, there were humans who still traveled on the roads, but they were vigilant. They were looking at all times for any danger. He wanted prey that was soft, complacent, thought they were safe. There was less danger from them. By midday, he was able to see a large expanse of woods, tall trees that no one had decided to harvest and turn into wooden siding, hardwood floors, furniture, or plywood. He chose to go through those woods rather than keeping to the field, searching for secured farmhouses and other rural buildings people had decided to make some sort of stand in. When he was about a football field away from the woods, he heard the sound of eating. He walked toward it, curious as to if it were any animal which would run off or threaten as he approached, or a zombie. As he got within sight, he saw it was a zombie. It was on all fours, face in a cadaver's abdominal cavity, feeding greedily. The body was fresh, and he tried to imagine why there was a single human, a male who looked to be a little younger than middle-aged, and it was here alone. A few yards away was a rifle that had been thrown with force and stuck into the ground. A backpack was a little further away. He imagined it had been removed to try and give the human more movement. Zombie was dressed in the tattered remains of what would have been a dress shirt and expensive pants, now ripped, without color, and caked in mud and blood. Zombies didn't moan as they ate. Having human flesh eased the pain that made them moan. The zombie also didn't move or change what it was doing. They only reacted to living humans or live animals when the pain and hunger were unbearable. He watched the zombie feed as it ignored the world around it. All it cared about was the meal in front of it. It didn't think about its next move, what was best for it in the long run, or that it was in danger right now. It fed. That was all it did. He watched, fascinated. The sheer simplicity of purpose, the relentlessness, and the inability to think beyond the now was something that humans had preached as a secret to happiness for centuries. And now, some had achieved it. All they had to do was die first. He looked at his own clothing. It was in much better shape. He gave a shit about his appearance because he could use it to unnerve his prey and get an advantage over them. He thought about how he waited until he knew he was safe before he fed. But mostly, he thought about how the advantages the dead have over the living are their numbers and their single-mindedness. They didn't care if the zombie next to them is killed, or they may not survive going through a glass window. They just drove forward. He kept looking at the zombie feed and how it would be easier for him if he just had them to clear his path. He could sacrifice them like pawns as he took victims. He walked past the zombie, thinking about it more, when the zombie stopped eating. He heard it stop, turned around, and watched as it slowly rose off the ground to its full height. He watched as it started walking toward him until it was just a few feet behind him. He stared at it, wondering what was happening. He felt an odd tickle in his mind. It was hard to put into words for Eddie. It was almost like a low vibration. He turned and started walking into the woods, and the zombie followed, slowly, shambling along as he walked. When Eddie stopped walking, it stopped as well. He closed his mind, cleared his thoughts, and all he could feel was a low vibration and the thought of finding more food. "Well, fuck me sideways," Eddie said out loud, realizing the dead thing was following him. He walked into the woods, thinking his hunting was going to get a whole lot easier. Interlude 2. 5 years ago. Chet Dean, yes, it was his real name, stared into the camera, waiting for the light to come on. He spent most of the afternoon meeting with the news editors and listening to how he was supposed to read the stories he'd been given for his hour on the air. He sneered as he talked about how the Democrats were saying that they needed to take the focus off Iran and start going after the zombies in the U.S. He tried to look reverent as he discussed the president's plan to make Saddam Hussein give him the results of his biological weaponry, since Iraq would have to have an antidote if they created the virus that caused the dead to come back to life. All other stories were being given short shrift. None of them mattered now. The head of the network was meeting with the president's team on a near hourly basis, making sure that they gave the story the White House wanted given. Everybody at VEX knew it was propaganda and lies to get people to quit thinking about the theory flying around the internet that the whole thing might have been caused by the U.S.'s own bioweapon research. The president's team rightly thought that if the people panicked about that, they wouldn't work hard to defend themselves, give up the cities, and let the country fall into chaos. Okay, more chaos. The people working in the newsroom didn't worry much about the zombie chaos outside because they had a National Guard unit on the main floor, and the Army Corps of Engineers was working hard to keep the channel on the air. Once things started falling apart, all of the VEX broadcast channels were converted into 24-hour VEX news channels. Not that it mattered a whole lot anymore, he thought glumly to himself. Many large cities had been given up, mostly in the states that voted for the Democrats, and the last statistics he had heard was that less than 75 channels were all still broadcasting. Most of them near Army bases or areas that were currently under a lot of snow, like Minnesota and Michigan. People were moving there as fast as they could, which wasn't as fast as they wanted, what with all the gasoline being taken by the military for the National Guard. Chet made it a practice not to watch the Carmen Dickens show, the one that was on before his, partly because he wanted to come into his broadcast fresh, and partly because the woman who had the show before his wouldn't sleep with him. "You have a disgusting body, and you actually believe the shit you tell the trolls who watch us," she'd said when he'd propositioned her at one of the parties, long before the zombies started showing up in Missouri, of all places. If there were a just and caring God, he would have made it so that the lesbian bitch was torn apart by zombies live on Charlie McCann's show. That would get the ratings into record territory. "What are you laughing about, Dean?" he heard over his earpiece. "You're on in 30 seconds, and people are being turned into foie gras. You had better look as serious as you did when we told you that you were too fucking stupid to run for office, let alone work for a real news organization. You screw up again, and Carmen gets a second hour for her show. People like looking at her, unlike you." If it was the director's intention to get him look pissed off when the camera came on, it worked. He ran through the news of the day he'd been given to read, as if he was reporting on his own house being stolen. He accentuated the news the way he always had, rolling his eyes at anyone who didn't follow the agenda laid out by the VEX CEO, interrupting them, and closing with his view, a carefully crafted editorial that worked in all the contempt that he could muster for those who didn't agree with his bias. Then he concluded by saying his stories had all been fair and balanced. When the camera went dark, he returned to his thoughts of what it would be like to see the little bitch torn apart on camera when he heard in his earphone, "All staff meeting in 5, pretty boy. Don't be late or your critter chow." If only he hadn't faked those interviews when he worked on 2020. He'd heard that the ABC people had been taken to a secure facility Walt Disney himself had built when he was worried about the Russians. That was, until they were knocked off the air by the White House for trying to do a story about how the zombies started to show up. No one had heard from them after that, and their broadcasts were replaced by the emergency broadcast system, which showed a lot of stuff from the Army, along with the evening VEX news broadcasts. There were rumors about what had happened to them, rumors no one ever talked about out loud. If the rumors were true, you wouldn't want to question anything coming out of the White House. If they weren't true, that meant what happened was even worse, and you definitely wouldn't want to question anything coming out of the White House. He left the studio, flanked by 2 National Guardsmen, in full battle fatigues, carrying M16s and looking for all the world like they were escorting a military leader to a summit conference. Maybe that's what he should have done with his life. Instead of being a political spokesman, actually run for office. He would have been able to prove his asshole producer that he was wrong and shove it in his face every time he asked for a press availability. Being in office was where the big money was. Had to be, or else people wouldn't have spent millions of dollars to get into office. Not that that mattered anymore when the president declared a state of emergency, suspended elections, then Congress voted to disband until the threat was dealt with. It hadn't mattered for a while anyway, being a rubber stamp once the first zombies were sighted. He got into the elevator and was quickly whisked to the top floor where the main meetings room were. The building still had power, thanks to an autonomous power system and a military-supplied generator. When he got to the top floor, he was quickly escorted to the main meeting room in the center of the building. It was actually able to hold over 500 people, a large meeting hall that reminded him of a freshman college class. Most everyone who worked in the building were there, other than a few people who were probably running a tape of some kind so that something was on the air. A rerun of an earlier show during primetime? This had to be big. He sat down quickly and noticed that there were about 20 National Guard troops in front of the main stage. It disturbed him a little how the people in the room were all chatting as if nothing was odd about the meeting. Yet looking out at them without saying a word or showing any emotion were 20 young men with weapons. A shudder went down his spine as he shifted in his seat. Carmen, who he hadn't noticed enter the room, sat down in the empty chair next to him. She was a short blonde woman who wore business suits, had hair as hard as frost, and a face that looked like someone had grabbed her ears and pulled back hard. Of course, she was on VEX News for one reason. Okay, 2 reasons. Both of them D-cups. She had no illusion about being a journalist, and constantly referred to what she did as a role. He hated her and wanted to fuck her doggy style with a sock in her mouth so he wouldn't be able to hear her painful California accent. "Have you heard anything about the meeting?" she said, leaning over and putting a hand on his arm. She smelled incredibly good, and he could feel a stirring that overcame his anger and disgust for what she'd done to him almost 3 years previously, and wondered if she would change her mind now that the world was ending. "Nothing," he said finally, putting his hand on hers and getting a bit more angry when she pulled away. She didn't have time to respond when the owner came out and stood before the podium. He was a stout little man who dressed in suits that might have made him look good 50 pounds ago, but now looked overstuffed and ridiculous on him. The guy had money. Why didn't he buy new suits when he outgrew them, Chet thought. "I don't want to waste a lot of time because we don't have very much of it," the old man started, his Aussie accent so thick that Chet had trouble understanding him as fast as he spoke. It reminded him of the time he went to a Shakespeare play and had to suffer through the first hour trying to figure out what the hell people were saying. "The president has informed me that he will be pulling his protection of us because there's simply no reason for us to be broadcasting at this point. Cities are falling, people are migrating to get away from the menace, and the military is going to go to its bases until scientists can discover a way to stop the zombies. Citizens are going to be on their own, but they do not need to know that. They will simply have to discover it for themselves. We are not to announce this because we have been told that this news is not to be reported. I am personally moving the network to a 30-second delay, and anyone who attempts to get this information out will be removed from the air and dealt with." He paused and looked at the troops standing in front of the stage before saying, "Dealt with severely." "Yes, very severely." Those who are not to be on the air for the rest of the day are to leave. Once you leave, you will not be allowed to re-enter. You may take your personal belongings for all the good they will do you. I will be leaving this building via my helicopter and going to an undisclosed location. This phrase brought a morbid chuckle from the people there, all of whom knew that the vice president had been running the country from an undisclosed location. It was thought to be impervious to any attacks. It was also thought that a number of businessmen who ran companies that had contributed heavily to the president's last campaign were there. I wish you luck because you will all need it. With that, he turned and left. Before the crowd could fully digest what had been said, one of the National Guardsmen jumped up on the stage and said, "This room is to be cleared immediately. Anyone still here in 5 minutes will be shot." Chet was near the door and one of the first ones out. The panic made it so he was shoved out of the room and into the hall. He was still in great shape since an anchor had to look good, and he was able to get to the stairway ahead of the chaos. As he gathered his stuff from his office, he heard someone say that 5 people had been killed in the stampede to get out of the room. He hoped that Carmen was one of them. He changed his mind and hoped she had just been injured. He felt bad for everyone who'd worked here now. But if she'd gotten injured, that would have made all of this worth it. Chapter 3. Charles woke with a start and reached over to see if Vic was in bed. Nothing there, but the bed was still warm. Maybe that was the thing that woke him up in the middle of the night, since he didn't remember a bad dream. The house was silent. He got out of bed, his body slow to respond, and looked out the window. Everything looked fine. He threw a robe on, since he was just wearing a t-shirt and running shorts to sleep in, checked on the kids. Rich and Martin, who shared a room, were sleeping peacefully. Jesse had kicked the covers off in the night. And Sarah was so tightly wrapped in hers, he thought she would have to be removed from her bed by the jaws of life. There was enough pale moonlight coming into each child's room that he didn't have to light a candle, and checking on them made him feel a little better about Vic's absence from the bed. Charles thought that Vic had to be downstairs checking on something, but he grabbed one of the shotguns before going down there. He hated having to do it, but Vic's warnings always ran through his head. Always bring a gun with you when you go to a different floor. You have no idea what has shown up since you were last there. There hadn't been a zombie in the house in over a year, but he always grabbed it out of habit. Besides, he had 4 children to take care of, and if there was something down there, he had to make sure that they were safe. He crept down the stairs slowly, the moonlight from the windows making it so he could see where he was going without much trouble. He wanted to grab a lantern or a candle, but most of them were downstairs in the kitchen. He got to the bottom of the stairs and said, "Vic, where are you?" Nothing. No sound from anywhere in the house. Now he was nervous. It wasn't like Vic to take off without letting him know, even if he was just getting a midnight snack. It was possible he'd gone outside to the outhouse, but Vic wasn't the kind of person who woke up in the middle of the night for things like that. The living room looked exactly like he'd left it. The futon had crumpled blankets on it, kids had a few toys on the floor, and the fire in the fireplace was glowing slightly. He went to the front door and checked it. Locked. If Vic went outside, he'd locked it after leaving, which was even stranger. Then, as he was looking out the window next to the door, he heard a thump behind him, far away. He spun quickly and raised the gun. "Vic," he said louder this time, "where are you?" Nothing. The sound had to have come from the kitchen or the dining room, both of which were behind big wooden doors. He crept to the doors of the dining room and slowly pushed them open. He looked inside and saw that nothing was different. The table and chairs all sat silently in the pale blue glow of night. He shut the door to the dining room quietly and moved over to the kitchen door. He paused, listening, causing his mind to stop thinking and concentrating on nothing but hearing what might be going on behind the door. There, in the stillness of the night, his head against the door, shotgun in his hands, he could hear something behind it. A slow, labored breathing. It was so quiet he could just barely hear it on the edge of his perception, but it was there. He wondered what it could be behind that door. Could Vic have injured himself and was passed out on the floor? Worse, could it be some sort of medical condition? He'd worried about that from time to time. What if one of them got sick or injured? Neither of them had any medical training other than a little bit of first aid, and they were both at the age where they had to worry about things like cancer, high blood pressure, and heart disease. He shook the thought out of his head. All he knew was that someone or something behind the door was having trouble breathing. He swallowed hard and gripped the shot even harder. He was going to have to open the door. But how? Bursting through with the gun at the ready to have the upper hand on whatever was there? Slowly pushing the door open to have the element of surprise? He toyed with the idea of sneaking around to the other door so he could hear better, but by the time he did that, he might be discovered by whatever was behind it, behind that damn door. He stilled his breathing and waited, hoping to hear some other sound, some other clue as to what was behind the door. Nothing. Just the same labored breathing, getting a bit shallower as time went on. He said a quick prayer to whatever god might be listening and shoved the door open. Charles was met with the sight that almost made him drop his gun. Vic was being held against the wall by a zombie's hand on his throat. The zombie was dressed in a flannel shirt, blue jeans, and despite having the gray skin tone of the zombies he'd seen, his face wasn't frozen in the rigor mortis of death like the other ones. Vic looked bad, blood all around the zombie's hand and his head hanging limp from the grip. If he wasn't completely passed out, he was amazingly close to unconscious. The whole scene was illuminated by the moonlight streaming through the window just to the left of them, and Charles wished for an instant that he was blind instead of having to see this. Charles held up the shotgun and tried to aim in such a way that he would nail the zombie's head without shooting Vic, but the zombie quickly positioned itself so that that wasn't possible. Then it hit him. The zombie had not just moved quickly, which was impossible, but was showing intelligence. "I don't think you want to shoot right now," the zombie said, its voice a sick parody of human sound. The voice gave Charles the image of bones being ground together, and some deep animal revulsion shuddered through his body. It spoke. The damn thing actually spoke. "You have me at a disadvantage," the zombie continued. "I know your friend here, but you have a gun and no idea who I am. However, since my hand is the only thing keeping your roommate here from bleeding to death, I think we might be able to work something out. You do anything else to him, and I swear to God I'll blow your heart into the next time zone," Charles said, his anger making his voice hard as steel. "It's not how someone talks about their roommate. It's how someone talks about their..." The zombie paused, its face twisting into a sick smile. "You two are together. I don't believe it. And I thought I was an abomination before the Lord." "Let him go," Charles said, moving forward ever so slightly with each word. "We discussed that already," the zombie said, tightening its grip and causing Vic to moan in pain. "If I let him go, he bleeds to death." "You seem to have quite the dilemma, and in today's world, I don't think there are a lot of gay bars you can hit to find someone to replace him." Charles's grip tightened on the shotgun, hoping that he could control his growing anger. "The fuck do you want, then?" he said. "Not you. Call me by my name, since it took a long time to remember it. Eddie. The name is Eddie. What I want is flesh. Preferably as much flesh as I can get. Those other shambling dead folks weren't as picky about what they eat as I am. But they'll be like me soon enough. You see, I am what they're becoming." Charles was confused, and the whole situation was becoming way too much for him to handle. "I was one of them. Now I can talk, think, and..." Eddie paused and then continued. "Well, I plan my killing. You have 4 children upstairs. Give me one of them, and I'll let this old poofta go. Deal?" Eddie smiled again, and Charles almost gagged. In the light of the moon, he could see the darkness around Eddie's mouth that just had to be blood. Vic was hanging there, limp, barely able to move. Maybe, just maybe, if they were able to find a doctor, and Eddie kept his word, Vic wouldn't die of his wounds. Then there would be the infection from the bite, and they'd discuss something like this. Their lives didn't mean as much as the children's, and they had both said they were willing to sacrifice everything for the children to live. Now the choice was clear and in front of him. A life for a possible chance at life? He quietly asked that Vic forgive him, closed his eyes for a second, just to gather the strength he needed for what he had to do. "It's a brain teaser, isn't it? Which person you love gets to die? Which of the people you care for gets to be a sacrifice to a higher being? You almost wonder, would cows be able to sacrifice their herd mates for their own lives?" Eddie taunted. That was all Charles needed. He opened his eyes and fired the shotgun, both barrels. The shots hit Eddie in the shoulder, causing him to drop Vic to the floor. Eddie screamed and leaped at Charles, who fired again, this time catching him in the midsection. Black liquid and chunks of flesh flew against the wall behind Eddie, who was knocked backward against the wall as well. Charles was aiming for another shot when he saw the black liquid that would have been blood in a live human being begin to coagulate quickly and start to reform Eddie's body. The shot caused him to pause, and Eddie took advantage of the pause and leaped out the window, shattering glass and leaving more thick black blood on the window frame. Charles ran to the window and looked, but there was no sign of Eddie outside. He looked around the room quickly and looked for the door to the outside. It was slightly ajar, and he knew that's where Eddie had to have gotten in. He ran over to it and flung it open, looking around with his shotgun at the ready. There was no sign of the zombie. He quickly stepped back inside and slammed the door, locking it behind him. He went to Vic's side and knelt by him. The slow, labored breathing had stopped. There was blood all over his neck and torso. He could feel the pain and loss well up inside him as he knew that his partner was dead. He put the shotgun to Vic's head and made sure the death was final. Then, and only then, did he allow himself to cry. It was only a few seconds after he'd made sure Vic wasn't coming back that the children arrived. Jesse, the oldest, opened the door and then quickly shut it. Charles could hear him take charge, telling the others to make sure the rest of the house was secure. Then he told them to go to the safe room and hide. Jesse came into the kitchen where Charles was sitting on the floor, no longer crying, but unable to even move. Jesse knelt down beside him, and acting far older than his 13 years, said, "We need to get this cleaned up, and we need to give Vic a decent funeral. Can you help me get him outside?" Charles looked at Jesse, the dim light obscuring most of his face, but his large eyes filled with a mix of pain and confusion. How was it that these children had to keep going through this? Why did they have to keep losing parents? What sort of uncaring God left them alive to deal with this horror on an endless basis? "Can you help me?" Jesse asked again. And Charles nodded dumbly and put the shotgun down. Together they took the body outside and then cleaned the kitchen in silence. Neither of them wanted to discuss what had happened. Finally, when the sun had come up and all the blood had been washed away, Charles told him everything that had happened. He had figured out that Eddie had gotten through the unlocked kitchen door. But how had he got through the gates? When they went outside to prepare a funeral pyre for Vic, they saw how. The front gate had been pulled open, the lock shattered. The zombie had to have incredible strength. Charles also knew the one thing that he would have trouble telling the children. They weren't safe here anymore. If that thing was able to get in once, it would get in again. They piled wood for the fire. Charles tried to figure out how best to tell the children that they would have to be sleeping in the safe room for the next couple of days as they prepared to leave. And he had no idea where they would ever be safe again.
That's right. Solitaire Rose Productions has sponsors. And our first sponsor is the one who's been with us since day one, and that's DreamHost.com. DreamHost.com is the best web host in the whole known universe, bar none. Go to DreamHost.com, enter the code CRAZY, get $20 off your first year. How amazing is that? Our second sponsor is the Dollar Shave Club. I get amazing razors delivered from the Dollar Shave Club just for a few bucks, and I always shave with a fresh blade. Does this make me a genius? Of course it does. Now, if you use the website shave.by/C19DC, those of us here at Solitaire Rose Productions, we'll get to wet our beak a little. We get a little piece of that. And that's what ads are all about. Our other sponsor is Graze. Graze delivers great healthy snacks to you weekly, bi-weekly, once a month, however you'd like. You can choose the kind of snacks you want. They're all amazing. They're all healthy. They're all good. And your first and fifth boxes are free if you use the code CORYS3R5. We love to hear from you, our fans, our beloved fans. Without you, there's no us, because then we're just talking to ourselves, and Lord knows I spent long enough doing that. You can email us at our brand spanking new email address at solitairerosenetwork@gmail.com. You can call us and leave a message, and we will play your message on the air. And that number is 952-856-0519. We have us a web page that is at Crazy Comics, KRAYZCOMIX.SolitaireRose.com, Over there, you'll see some of our new sponsors and our brand spanking new Amazon store. So go check that out. We are also on the Facebooks. We're all over the place. We want to hear from you. If you would like to advertise on Crazy Comics and Stories or any of the other Solitaire Rose podcasts, go ahead, email us at solitaireroseproduction@gmail.com. Subject, advertising. If you have a comic you would like us to review, it's the same Gmail account. Just instead of advertising, put review. Or if you'd like to be a guest on Solitaire Rose Radio or Solo Joe, go ahead and email us at that same address with the subject line, guest. These here podcasts come to you free because of our sponsors, so please go visit them. Crazy Comics and Stories comes to you free every week. Every Monday, we've got a new episode, and usually we have it up by Sunday night. It's also available on the YouTubes. It's available on the Pocket Cast, on the Stitcher, on the iTunes. It's all over the place. So go ahead, subscribe, tell your friends, tell every human being you know about Crazy Comics and Stories. Solitaire Rose Radio is a little more infrequent. It comes out about every 2 weeks. And Solitaire Rose Novelcast comes out every other Thursday. So get ready. The Solitaire Rose Podcast Network is growing. Join us. Be on board. Become a fan. Become a listener. Thank you. Two things about this episode. First is, this is the first podcast I've recorded since my cat, Fidget, passed away. Those of you who've listened to the podcast before have probably heard her. If you listen to my other podcasts, I've told stories about her. Fidget was a cat that I didn't go out of my way to get. I was dating a woman in California. I live in Minnesota. I met her online. I'd flown out a couple of times to see her, and I flew out for her birthday. And while we were there, someone who was on a mailing list that we were on, one of those email mailing discussion lists, who lived in LA, said that they were told by their landlord that they had to get rid of all their pets, that she had too many cats. And when we went there, it was a studio apartment, and there were two cats and a bunch of kittens. And we had promised to take one of the kittens, so we took the kitten. And when we went back to where this woman lived, as we're bringing the cat in, we're told, "You can't have pets here." Now, of course, this devastated her. She's very much a cat lover, and she didn't want to have to give the cat away, didn't want to have to take the cat to a shelter. And I said, "Well, I tell you what, I'll bring the cat home with me. Then the next time I come out," we were talking about scouting apartments that we could get together, "we'll make sure it's an apartment where they have cats and you can have the cat there." So I flew back. The cat was in a cat carrier, and the cat, when we got it back to the apartment, had freaked out and hid under the bed and was under the bed the entire rest of the visit. Didn't come out except to eat and use the litter box. So getting her out from under the bed and into the cat carrier was not a pleasant thing. The cat did not enjoy the flight. And I had a two-hour layover in George Bush Airport in Houston. And people, women especially, would come up and, "Oh, it was such a pretty cat." And I said, yeah, she's not happy about the trip. I got her back here, and again, got her out of the cat carrier, boom, right under my bed. She was not a cat who liked people. It took her a long time to warm up to me. You know, for the first few days, she just hid under the bed the whole time. And then I, read up a lot about cats, because I'd had farm cats, but I hadn't had a house cat. I like cats. I like that cats are very independent. I like that cats kind of take care of themselves. I like that they're not needing you. They can like you, but they don't need you. But anyway, she slowly would come out and kind of sit in the same room with me. And then she would sit closer to me. And then eventually, a couple of months later, she would come up, sit on my lap, do things like that. But the entire time, when I would go to bed, I'd shut my bedroom door, but she wanted to be in the bedroom. And I didn't want the cat sleeping in my bed. So I would shut the door, and I would wake up, and the cat would be there in the bed. And I was... the door was shut. I had no idea what she was doing. She was, as long as a cat can get their head under things, and there's a big gap between in my bedroom door, so she was able to get through that gap and up. And eventually I gave up and let her sleep in the bed with me.
Her name was Fidget because she was always in motion, always fidgety, always moving, kind of a hyper cat. And she became what I would call my jealous girlfriend. If anybody came into the house, if anybody came near me, and if anybody went in the bedroom, she would attack them. To her last days, if anybody other than me went in my bedroom, she would attack them. Jen Wicked is on the Crazy Comics and Stories podcast, and when she came to visit me after us not being around each other for, gosh, years, she was like, oh, what a pretty cat. And I said, remember, she doesn't like people. She doesn't like people in the room. And of course, Jen had to reach out, try and pet the cat. The cat, of course, attacked her, clawed her hand. And yesterday, I came home. And normally she comes running to when I open the door. Sometimes she'll wait like 15, 20 minutes, you know, kind of make me wait. But that's been our routine. She moved in 2001, and that's been the routine. And she didn't come. I didn't think anything of it for a while, and then it was, wonder where she is. I went through the house, went to all her normal perch places. She wasn't there. I opened a can of tuna, because that always brings her. Nothing. And that's kind of when I knew. And I went, and I looked under my bed. And she was there, but she was gone. We get so attached to these small, fragile animals. They become a part of our life. They become companions. And while I understand that animals don't, we tend to project human emotion onto animals. We tend to think of animals as being like us, and they aren't. But when you buy a pet, you know that you're buying future heartbreak. You know that's the deal. That they will be with you, and they will love you, and they will be attached to you, and they will care about you in their own way. But eventually they're going to leave before you do. And yesterday, the bill came due. And it was weird while I was recording and mixing this episode, because I'm used to her hearing my voice when I'm recording and coming out and wanting to, you know, clawing at my leg and wanting in my lap and thinking I'm talking to her and demanding attention, and me just kind of, no, come on. And I'll give her some attention, but then when she starts clawing, wanting more, I'll take out the spray bottle, which I still have right here, and going, okay, over there. And then she would retreat to the couch and watch. And then eventually, you know, the spray bottle wore off like in 15 minutes and she'd come back. So as I'm recording this episode, you forget, because it was just yesterday. You kind of forget because you're in the middle of things. And you're going, okay, I need to get ready for when she... Oh yeah, she won't. I don't want to get all Marc Maron and go on and on and on about cats. But Novelcast is... first one I've recorded and mixed and put together that she hasn't been here. So, this episode is dedicated to Fidget. There's also a special thing I'm adding at the end of this episode. One of the things that I've done the past couple of years, Mario Muscar from the Comic Geek Speak board, and he's been on a couple of other podcasts. Every year he asks people to contribute a story for Christmas. He calls it the 12 Stories of Christmas. And he asked me to do one last year. It was a very busy time, so I took one of my older short stories and put it together for him. It's over on the Solitaire Rose Radio, if you want to hear the audio recording of it. It's called PG-13. This year I wrote a new story for him, and while I think it would be nice if I did it as a Solitaire Rose Radio, and maybe I will in the future, but it's a very short story. It's not that long. It has nothing to do with Christmas, but I'm going to add it here as kind of a special feature, kind of a bonus after credit thing. So here you go. Here's a short story that I wrote about 2 weeks ago. I want to thank you for listening. I want to thank you if you subscribe. I want to thank all the people who've sent emails to tell me what I can do better. The people who have put the information on their podcast or shared the link. Please friend me on Facebook and so you can get updates about the shows. Please go to Solitaire Rose Novelcast on Facebook and click like. The more likes I get, the more people will know about it, the more listeners I'll get. Give us a review on iTunes and Stitcher and any place else, and tell people. And I'll be back in 2 weeks with the next part of After the Fall. Rush Job by Corey Strode. Rich had barely settled into his desk when the call came. The police told him that Joe, one of the artists who worked at High Action Publications, had been killed on Friday. He'd been hit by a subway train after falling onto the tracks. They had no further details, but they were calling because they knew it was his place of work, and they had no information on next of kin. Rich set the phone down without telling the officer he would do so, and asked his secretary, Angie, to bring him Joe's file. She didn't ask why after looking at him and seeing his face pale with shock. He sat back down and picked up the phone, apologizing to the officer for setting the phone down. And when Angie brought him the file, he leafed through it to find Joe's emergency contact. He'd written doctor in the space. Any other time, Rich would have laughed. Sorry, officer. He left no information, Rich said, ending the call. The offices at High Action Publications were small. Only his office, 6 desks for editors, his secretary, and a small room for artists to work in if they were running late on deadlines. The floors were polished, dark wood, and the walls were painted with dark colors, giving the office a feeling of somberness, even on sunny days. It was just after 9 a.m. on a Monday, and most of the other people who worked there didn't show up until after 10 a.m. Many of the editors also wrote stories for the magazines, so they would often stay up late at home writing, and then come in to have the other editors work the stories over to get them into shape for publication. Rich called Angie into his office and let her know what had happened. She was a young girl, fresh out of high school, and always looked like she was playing dress-up in her business dresses. She started crying, and Rich handed her a box of tissues and said, "We'll shut down for the day once everyone has come in. I'm sure we'll find out the arrangements." She nodded and went back to her desk, shutting the door behind her. Rich went through Joe's personnel file. He'd started working there in 1963 and produced more covers and interior art pieces than anyone else in the 7 years he'd worked there. He rarely worked at home, saying he didn't have room for the paints he used for covers, and preferred the office's art board to whatever he could find. Richard thought he worked in the office so that he wouldn't be alone. Joe had been a quiet artist who had incredible speed. More than once he had painted a magazine cover in record time when another freelancer blew his deadline. He had a love for bourbon, and usually had some in a mug as he painted, but he didn't need it when he did pen and ink drawings. He was also generous, kind, and always willing to help around the office when he was there. He did paste-ups, proofreading, ad placement, and even took calls when Angie was away. Rich stared out his office window at the bullpen and remembered Joe wandering around from desk to desk, getting ideas for magazine covers from the editors. He wasn't begging for work. He was usually bored and looking for something to do. Now he wouldn't come in anymore. As other staffers came in through the morning, he met them at their desks and let them know what he had heard. Most hadn't heard, but when Big John came in, Rich could see by how he walked, he already knew. John was a bear of a man, and he normally walked in as if he were late for everything. That day, however, he walked slowly, his eyes focused downward, his shoulders slumped, and his face more dour than usual. When he got to his desk, he looked around and said, "So everyone knows?" "Yes," Rich said, sitting down in the chair next to Big John's desk. "I knew I should have stayed at the bar longer Friday night. After we put Manly Adventures to bed, I asked everyone here if they wanted to go to the corner bar to celebrate hitting the deadline. Joe came along with us. I left to catch a train and asked if he was coming. He was working on a blonde waitress who wasn't brushing him off, and he said he'd be closing the place down. When I read the paper..." He trailed off. Rich put a hand on his shoulder and said, "You can go home if you want. We're not going to get much done this week." "I'd rather work," Big John said. "If I go home, I'll just keep thinking I should have got him on the train instead of letting him stumble to the station. There have been a few nights I've had to prop him up on the train to get him home." He was an adult. He could take care of himself, Rich said. Obviously not, was Big John's answer. Rich went back to his office and worked on the paperwork they would need to send to the insurance company, the payroll department, and the other forms needed when someone would no longer be working. No longer be working. A nice way of saying dead. Rich tried to put the morbid train of thoughts to bed and concentrated on filling in the empty lines and the typed forms. The office phone rang a few times over the next half hour, and Rich didn't pay attention as Angie picked each one up. By the time he was done, everyone who worked in the office had come in, been informed, and was given the option to go home. No one did. They all wanted to work. And Rich saw they were all working in silence, mostly on tasks that didn't require a lot of thought, pasting up ads, light accounting, even cleaning their desks. No one moved to clean the things that Joe had left in the office. Small art supplies on Big John's desk, his coffee mug still next to the art board, his bottle still in Angie's bottom desk drawer. Right before noon, Angie knocked on Rich's office door, and he waved her in. She shut the door behind her and said, "I have a woman on the phone who wants to speak to you. Please take a message. I want to get this paperwork done." "You'll want to take this call," she said. Rich trusted her as always, picked up the receiver and said, "Hello? Is this the man in charge at the magazine company?" came the female voice on the other end of the phone. "Yes," he said, watching Angie leave his office and wondering what this was about. "I saw in the paper about that artist who worked for you passing away. It's a terrible thing, just terrible. My son was coming home from work that night and told me what happened." "Was he there?" "No, no, no," the lady said. "He was on the next train, but there were a lot of people who did see it. He asked them why the trains were late, and a nice gentleman told him it was because a woman had fallen onto the tracks, and a man jumped down to help her back on the platform. She was able to get up, but he didn't. He saved that lady's life. I saw in the paper that a man died on that platform, and my son told me it had to be the story he'd heard. I wanted to send flowers to that poor man's wife. Can you help me?" "He wasn't married, man," Rich said. "He was a bachelor, and he spent a lot of time here at the office. We don't need any flowers, but I want to thank you for calling." Rich had trouble getting her off the phone. She wanted to know if there was anything she could do. Her husband had died in a similar accident. She was grateful for the neighbors who had helped her, and she wanted to do the same for other people. Rich thanked her and eventually agreed to a deli tray being sent to the office some afternoon. After he ended the call, he gathered everyone together and told them what the woman had said. He then said, "I'd like us to run his story in all our magazines this month. Use one of his covers, and if we don't have enough new ones, use one of the older ones." He went back to his office, was going to get back to work when Big John knocked on his office door. Rich nodded. He came in and shut the door behind him. "What is it?" Rich asked. "I don't think that story was true," John said, his normal booming voice barely above a whisper. "He was drunk when I left at 9. If the accident was at midnight, I doubt he was drinking sody pop to sober up for those 3 hours. He was on a bender." "We don't know, John," Rich said. "He wasn't happy, Rich. He felt like he'd pissed away his life and had nothing to show for it. He'd gone most of the night talking about how his paintings were on newsstands for a month and then gone. He didn't have a kid, didn't have a wife. He felt like he'd wasted all the money his parents had spent sending him to art school. I know he wasn't happy. Happy people don't start drinking at 10 in the morning," Rich said. "But we have a woman who says he was a hero, and goddammit, we're going to let people know he died a hero. Just because he was a drunk doesn't mean he couldn't do the right thing." "I suppose," Big John said. He got up quietly, then turned and said, "I don't mean to disrespect the dead. You know that, right?" "I know. It's all right. We're all pretty shook up." After Big John left, Rich couldn't concentrate on Joe's paperwork anymore, so he decided to work on invoices till the end of the day. Mindless work until he could go home and spend the night with his wife. Get away from this office and the pain hovering in the air. At lunch, most of the staff didn't come back. Rich walked through the office and put the work they had left unfinished in their desks. After lunch, most of the staff didn't come back. Rich walked through the office and put the work they had left unfinished on their desks away. Started cleaning just so he could be doing something that didn't require thinking. Angie always took a late lunch and came back with the afternoon paper. She gave her copy to Rich and said, "It's on page 10. Rich didn't ask what, and instead opened the paper to page 10. was a story about a man who, late Friday night, had attempted to move between cars on the train, got disoriented, fell on the tracks, and was killed by a passing train. It did state in the story that the police weren't giving any information, and it was near one of the platforms, and the story was from eyewitnesses. Rich gave it back to Angie and said, "It's a tabloid story. They talked to a couple of people, not the police. They're usually about as accurate as the psychics in the horoscope magazines." But, she started, Rich stopped her and said, "Story said the police didn't talk to them. It means either they said it was crap, or they didn't bother to fact check. We know more than they do." To Rich, that was the end of it. The next day felt a little better, and on Wednesday, they were told the funeral would be Friday. Rich told people that the office would be closed on Friday so that they could attend. Joe's parents were dead, he had no siblings, and Rich was sure they would be the only people in attendance. By Thursday, all Rich could think about is that he didn't want to be alone when his time came. He wanted someone to be there for him at home. He wanted family and friends to be able to take care of the arrangements rather than someone from the state like Joe. The deli tray had arrived, with a kind note, and the people told stories about Joe as they made sandwiches. There had been laughter for the first time since Monday morning, and the gloom finally started to lift. The office had not fully returned to the fun, busy place it had been the previous week, but Rich felt they were on their way. People were talking again. Ideas for cover stories were being discussed, and Angie didn't break down crying every hour like she had done on Monday and Tuesday. Around 4 in the afternoon that day, a policeman showed up in the office. He was an older officer, in uniform, and had a dour face from having to tell too many people bad news. He was brought into Rich's office, where he was offered a seat. "No, thank you," the officer said, waiting until the door was closed. "How can I help you, officer?" "I was told there was an artist here who was killed in an accident Friday night." Rich nodded, and the officer went on. "He had no family, and you were listed as his contact, so we wanted to let you know the results of our investigation. From talking to eyewitnesses, we determined that he fell on the tracks after having too much to drink." "We'd heard he'd saved a woman who'd fallen onto the tracks," Rich said. "No one stated that, sir," the officer said. Rich thanked him and ushered him from the office. He watched as the officer went to deliver bad news to whomever was next on his list, and thought about the tribute they were putting together for Joe. He shut the office door and Big John asked, "What'd the officer have to say?" "He said Joe died a hero," Rich said, smiling and heading back to his office. He finished his daily task and was putting things in his briefcase when Angie came in and shut the door behind her. "What is it? I was about to go home." "I heard what the officer told you," she said, "and the hero story isn't true." "So what?" Rich said. "All our magazines will be telling the wrong story. We'll have it out there and it's not true." "It doesn't matter. We aren't a newspaper. We aren't reporters. Will anyone be hurt thinking that our friend was a hero when he was someone who killed himself with booze?" When Angie finally said no, it was as quietly as she could talk and still be heard. "Then we say it was a hero. We never tell anyone he's not. I think that's a better gift than flowers, don't you?"